Welcome to Big Blend Radio with your hosts, Lisa and Nancy, editors of BigBlendMagazine.com.
Welcome, everybody. We're very excited today. We have Sam Steer joining us to talk about his debut novel. It's called The Edge of Elsewhere. And it's super cool because it's taking the issues of climate change and merging it with sci-fi. And that is, you know, you got to think about it. We always think about what's going to happen. We're seeing all the reports on, global warming, pollution and all of that. And you think, okay, at the end of the day, where are we going? And that's kind of that cool thing that he's put together in his book. And it also looks about the Earth's beauty. And that's important, too, because our natural space and everything we have around us is a beauty. So we want to protect it. So very excited to have him join it. His book is out now, The Edge of Elsewhere. You can get it on all the online stores, Amazon, all those places. And don't forget to ask your independent bookstore to also carry it. And you can also go to his website. It's elsewheresedge.com. So welcome, Sam. How are you doing?
Oh, good. I'm fine. I'm here in Pennsylvania enjoying a beautiful, partly cloudy day in central Pennsylvania.
Cool. Now, are you going to do the polka? I just have to say that. I'm just kidding. The Pennsylvania polka.
I'm generally more of a house person. As opposed to a polka dancer. So
okay, there it is. He's a little different on that. No, I have to mess with you all that. But up in central Pennsylvania. I know Nancy and I have traveled a lot through Pennsylvania this year. We're going to do some more, and this might be airing while we're in Pennsylvania too. As we record it today, Nancy and I are in Peachtree City, Georgia, and it's really fun to start reading your book here because this is the place where they film all the zombie movies and The Walking Dead. And when I think about climate change, I feel like we're going to end up there. That's what we're going to be looking like at the end of it when you think about what's happening in the world. And getting into more sci-fi things, it's interesting that you put the two, sci-fi and climate change. Do you read a lot of sci-fi?
Oh, no, I really don't have much time to read novels, but I did as a kid, and I really enjoy sci-fi movies and articles and things like that. It's actually when you merge sci-fi and climate change, there's a new term called cli-fi, and I think that's starting, and this book falls under that heading of cli-fi. And we need more of it. We need imagination to turn to this issue to bring it more in the forefront of the media and pop culture. Yes.
I think that's I think it's absolutely true. I've started reading it, and I'm enjoying your writing as well. Takes you just, you're right there, but I want to ask you to give everyone kind of an overview of the story so that I don't mess it up and give anything away, but it's cool.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Well, the story takes place in several different times. It starts off in the World's Fair in 1963. Mm-hmm. It turns out that Albert Einstein was able to time travel. He didn't make that public, but did figure out the keys or did figure out the mathematics behind time travel. And he, of course, he died in 1955, but the book starts in 1963 at the World's Fair. And he comes and he is amazed at, he traveled from 1943 past his death in 1955 to 1963. So he basically traveled from World War II to the beauty, the progress, and the peace of 1963 in the United States, in New York, Flushing Meadows, New York, and he's amazed at the progress and the peace and the way people are to each other. He's never experienced this before. And then he talks to people, and then he sees the Unisphere, which is that metal globe. It's gray metal globe. And he realizes there's something wrong with what's happening. There's peace, there's prosperity, there's happiness, there's joy, there's technology. But man's symbol of the future is the Earth, and perhaps satellites orbiting the Earth. But it's gray, it's steel, and it's cold. Nature will be forgotten in mankind's pursuit of advancement in technology. That's what the preface leaves you with. And then the book breaks to 2079, which is more or less it's 60 years from now, but about 100 years from Einstein's travels. 2079, the Earth is in a bad spot. There's been runaway climate change. Glaciers have melted. Sea levels have risen. CO2 levels in the atmosphere have gone up, creating a much warmer world, a much more damp world, cloudy, and basically, there have been a lot of forest fires. The world is covered with the ash of nature. The book starts in New Jersey, in Princeton, New Jersey. And these kids have inherited this world, and they make the best of things. There's a lot of deprivation going on, and it's made clear in their lives and in their recent pasts. For example, their father, there's Abby and Paul. Their father passed away a few years back of a simple pneumonia. And they live in or near the ruins of Princeton University. And then they discover things, and they discover Einstein's way of time traveling. He wrote it down. He kept it hidden. But one day they went into his house, and they found something hidden, and with Abby's brother, Paul, who is someone who is housebound because of asthma, they figure it all out, and they do indeed, after a bit of traveling and walking through the desolate earth or the world where they live. I gave it a bit of a description as they were traveling kind of do some world building from the year of 2079. But they find a means of time travel, and they go back to 1971, New York City, Central Park, and they meet people. They meet hippies. They realize what was lost, and they also realize the hopelessness of not being able to change things, because embedded in human nature is a disregard for the natural world and a usurpation of the natural world. They discover that, and they discover that there's no changing it, but they do other things that give them meaning in life. And that is the key by which the future itself can be changed. It's a book of hope. It's a book of hope, and it's kind of a new perspective, not from what we see, but from what our children's children will see, and what we are missing now, and perhaps what we can recapture to build a better future. It's kind of like a fable, you know. It involves music from the 60s and 70s, some things that were remembered and sung to her years ago in Abby's mind. It involves art. She knows nature by looking at art in books, disregarded books from Princeton Library. She knows what was lost, but only through books. And she experiences the past by considering pieces of art she knows about. And she She is considers poets from 19th and 20th century her friends, and she thinks in terms of their poetry. So I think it's an insightful book. I think it plants the seeds for a different way of thinking and a different way of looking at the world.
I like the time travel is smart. I think the time travel part is really smart because, you know, we want to show what it was like in the past. You want to see this is what it's coming, where we're headed. That's important.
Yes.
And have that urgency, but also, like you said, it's there is beauty in there because if it's over alarming, people turn off. You know what I mean? If there isn't that beauty side of it too, there's got to be
hope.
Positivity.
And
hope.
Yeah. Well, there must be hope. Otherwise, you know, what's the point? And that is even mentioned in the book too, that they're searching for hope and they want to find hope and they find a reason to hope and to make their lives worthwhile. So, if you look at kids nowadays, boy, I was really struck. Kids that went out in the street last year and tried to, you know, make raise awareness. This was before all that pandemic, all this pandemic stuff. But kids, you know, it was kind of almost a party atmosphere. But they're doing something. Not so much the 20 somethings, but the kids, you know, the teen, early, younger teens and the 10-year-olds and the 8-year-olds, you know, so there is hope that way. This book was kind of written for them, you know.
Yeah. And I think it's important too, because if I was a teenager right now, it would scare me about it. It would be scary. I mean, that's the one thing I keep looking at with what's going on in the world. Even, you know, just all the political fights. And I mean, it just doesn't feel like so exciting to be here, you know, for young, you know, youth. And Nancy, you know, this is, you know, interesting with you in you know, going back to the 70s and the hippie side.
Mm-hmm.
And you were saying, you know, everything we're talking about now was, you know, you were out there saying, hey, you know, and it's here, it's happening. And so you can't say it wasn't there.
No,
that's what
true.
That's what I tried to capture. See, I was born in 63. I mean, the 70s were, I mean, you know, I don't remember much of the 60s. I start to remember the 70s. But there was an energy and a positive and a sense that something, we can change things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Vietnam War and protesters and, you know, and they did that. And I think that's what's needed now. On a global scale, this idea that the world can still people can find and search and think their way out of this. You know, we're going down a wrong direction. We can pull back and go a different direction. Young people need to make this more. Need to put this in front of us, you know, and the baby boomers also need to recognize what this is and go back to the 60s and 70s and remember back then what it was like to feel hopeless almost and to rage against that and protest. We need to get that back here.
And I think part of the solution would be to somehow change our political system where younger people will be able to run and not have to be a millionaire or a billionaire in order to run for office. I think that we need younger people in the government, in the spaces.
Absolutely.
There.
Of course.
Because
when
you look at, you know, when you look at our Senate and our Congress, and you look at all these old, old people, sorry, people.
Falling asleep.
Yeah, I'm falling asleep. I don't know that they're making laws that are going to help the youth, or they're making laws that are protecting their own personal property, where their minds are at.
And again, this is mentioned in the book, but people, I used the 40-year-old when, you know, a distinction is made in the book between older and younger people. Older people tend to be focused on the status quo because that's where their interests lie. Younger people are invested in their future because that's where their hope is. You know, and there's always that, and there's always going to be that. But older people must look at their kids as their ultimate investment, and where, you know, and where their kids are going to be living and where their kids' kids are going to be living. I just don't see that here, you know, especially where I live. Nobody thinks that way. Everyone's, I don't know, they're fracking everywhere and, you know, just doing the opposite of what should be done. I'm worried about fracking. I'm worried that our country is investing more and more in fossil fuels. Other countries are turning away from fossil fuels. We are rebuilding our economy on fossil fuels. The exact worst thing that could be done. We're doing. I mean, I hate to say this, but Europe and Asia are thinking ahead. We're thinking of prosperity of the past, which is fossil fuels. Other countries are building solar cells, and we're digging the earth for fossil fuel. You know, I mean, it's not an absolute black and white thing, but America has gone backwards on this, and this is the defining issue of the 21st century. Who's ever in power now is thinking backwards.
Exactly.
And sooner or later, our prosperity is going to be sunk by it.
Yeah. It's, you know, we lived in Kenya for a few years, and then we lived in South Africa for a few years. We lived in England for a few years. And when we came back to this country, we'd been out of the country for so long that it was like for us, even though we were both born here and lived here for many years, when we returned here, it was like going to a whole different world compared to how other people are handling problems around the world or in the places that we lived. And this is a very money-oriented society. And that seems to be how we make our decisions. It's about money and comfort, convenience, more than what is really good and healthy for people.
Yeah, I see that. And I see that here with the fracking industry.
Yeah.
You know, it's a terrible thing to see.
To see
this and to see bigger and bigger SUVs. It's just, we are going down the wrong direction. And I speak of our country. I speak of our country more than any place, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I think also traveling around, we're seeing there's the fracking, but we're also seeing oil wells in people's backyards. And that's like a whole, it's wild in certain areas. I've seen that. And I'm like, well, you know, what's happening? I mean, how healthy can that be? The one thing I like in your book, you talk about Paul, Abby's brother, being asthmatic. And I think, you know, it's interesting, you know, the asthma. I wonder if we would have had asthma as much without all this pollution. You know, I was talking to a friend the other day in North Carolina. He's like, gosh, I'd love to see you guys when you get here, but I've got asthma. And so the COVID thing, he doesn't, you know, the whole, he just quarantined in. He's not going out anywhere because of it. And he said he got it from living in LA for so many years. And I'm like, that's where it is.
Sure.
So I think asthma is it's like being a canary in the mine, you know?
Oh, sure, sure. Yeah. And there's, I think there is a link between fracking and asthma in kids. The connection, the book is about connections. And what I was implying with Paul's condition is, number one, it's brought about by, of course, pollution, but also by the degradation of nature and dust. Also, it's an incredibly treatable disease with what we have now. But what we have now in terms of technology and medicines, we might not have in 50 or 100 years because of a depleted infrastructure due to climate change. I mean, climate change affects everything from water to people, to where people live, coastal areas. Mm-hmm. It affects food supply. I'm just concerned. My great fear, it's almost like the fear of living with nuclear war in the 70s.
That's how I feel. That's why I said about the zombies, is that kind of feeling of the unimaginable could happen when, you know, and I wonder too about new diseases. I know you're a physician as well. So there's that other part of climate change. And I wonder things like COVID and the pandemic. I wonder if with this climate change, are we not getting new bacteria and viruses popping up because the climate, the temperature is changing? And the immune system of the land is gone, you know?
I think we're going to see more diseases, more epidemics, more pandemics, because number one, people are going to be moving from bad areas to not so bad areas. And I'm not talking about moving. I'm talking of individuals or even communities. I'm talking about entire populations of people moving. And, you know, and of course there's going to be problems with infrastructure and clean water. And there's going to be perhaps with the melting of the tundra, perhaps germs and viruses that humans have never been in contact with are going to be regenerated, you know, with ice melting and the tundra melting And another impetus for the book is that this is COVID is a dress rehearsal for what I think could potentially happen with the health issues of climate change. With COVID, we may have a light at the end of the tunnel, i.e., a vaccine or a drug. With climate change, there is no light at the end of the tunnel because when the systems start collapsing, they cannot. It's going to get worse and worse. The hole will get deeper and deeper. Everything that we're doing now is making that more likely.
I don't want to go down that hole.
What's that?
I don't want to go down there.
Well, that's why I wrote the book, and that's why I'm talking to you now, and perhaps other people listening to this could say, oh, geez, holy smokes, maybe we should look at the world a little, just a bit differently. Maybe Sam Steele has something there. Let me consider this cli-fi a book. Let me consider a different point of view. Perhaps our elected officials should see this or feel this more somehow, or maybe look at it from a different perspective. Do you know that movie? There was a movie that came out in the 80s called The Day After. Do you remember that? It was about a nuclear war and the day after.
No.
Does that sound familiar?
No.
Yeah.
I might have seen it.
Write it down. It was a made-for-TV movie about nuclear war. And I really think that changed perception and perspectives. It changed perspectives of people in power. It was called The Day After. I think it was 1983. And I remember watching it in college, and it scared the hell out of everyone. And I remember there was even interviews with, I think it was one of Reagan's, someone on Reagan's staff at the time. But I do think it changed perspectives, and I think it led to denuclearization in the late 80s. That's what popular culture and what science and what fiction can do. It could just allow people a different perspective and perhaps a more real perspective than or perhaps a perspective that people don't necessarily want to start thinking about because it's too scary.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the arts have always been the best, you know, delivery of good and bad messaging. You know, in other words, like telling the story of what is going on. And it has actually been a really good way of telling the truth and sharing history. And because the arts are a way of their living history. You know, they're always giving what's going on in the day now. I mean, that's the beauty of like the music from the 70s and late 60s and 70s. They were like, hey, man, you know, what's going on? You know, hey, now,
well, yeah.
You know, they were doing a lot of that. And I think that's,
Yes. And at some level, art can make history. You know, look at the book. It was called Uncle Tom's Cabin. It was written. I forget who wrote it. I forget her name. Beecher Stowe, Harriet Beecher Stowe.
Yeah.
She wrote it. I don't think it didn't cause the Civil War, but it changed perceptions of slavery, which made abolition of slavery more likely because it changed perspectives. It put people into that world, people in the North. And I think Queen Victoria cried over the novel. But art can be a powerful vehicle in that way. Art could be a medium change as opposed to reflecting society, you know, as opposed to being a reflection of society.
Yeah, I think we need art for change, and we need to really examine our political system and maybe look at who should be running for office based on what kind of experience. You know, like, why would somebody be in charge of something they know nothing about? For example, the commander-in-chief of our forces in this country is the president, and if he's never served, why should you be chief of something you've never done?
Well, you know.
I'm just thinking we maybe are how we're running things needs to reflect something a little bit more make sense. You know, like you wouldn't have a head of a hospital know nothing about medicine or.
Sure.
Yeah. So that's what I'm saying. Like, I wouldn't want a chef to make dinner for me who's never cooked. So,
of course.
Yeah. So,
it's up to people to vote the right people into office. That's the issue. That's the real issue.
Yeah.
And for example, I think there was a, you know, right now Biden is the Democratic nominee. But 6 months ago, I believe the governor from Washington was running on a climate change platform, but he left early, I think, because the race wasn't this. Boy, that would have been a major shift in thinking to have to. I forget his name. Governor Washington. Mm. Maybe somebody can Google it. But boy, would have shaken things up.
Well, yeah, because the thing is, we've got the money. It's about who's paying what, and that's part of the broken part of our system is, you know, who's paying for what, and that's where it shouldn't be that way. It really shouldn't. You shouldn't have to have all this money to run. All that money could go into homelessness and cleaning up our drains, and you know, cleaning up schools that have mold in them. You know, cleaning up our environment, and instead of these hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars that go into all these people's pockets for nothing, we could really. And it's so to me, the election system isn't fair at all that way. And there should be no campaign contributions. It should be real debates that are handled a little bit better.
after that last one. But again, it all comes down to an informed democracy, an informed electorate. I guess that's the right word, an informed democracy. I don't know, this issue has been, I don't know if the word is neglected, but it's been it's not been approached. And it may be because it's scary, or maybe it's just too, it goes against the grain of what we think are the underpinnings of our economy, i.e. the fossil fuel industry, and no one wants to touch that.
Yeah.
But it's been underrepresented in our schools and in our dialogue and even in our art. And again, that's why the book is made.
I think it's also, I think people, fear, right? Change is always brings about fear. And I think people have this absolute paranoia of being unplugged, you know.
Well, they're in denial.
There's a fear of not having, you know, electricity. And so fossil fuels is a big deal because it's like, oh my gosh, we're going to end up with no electricity, which is not true. Maybe there's solar, there's all kinds of new things. So there's all of those fears and there's comfort, right? And change is not a fun
Change is always difficult, but boy, we just need to look right over the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
We need to look right over the crest of the next hill to know that change is absolutely and fundamentally needed right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure where this election is going, but boy, we could really start right now, you know.
I totally agree.
And who's ever listening to this podcast out there in, you know, podcast land, see the world through perhaps the eyes of your children yet to be or your children's children. And the science is absolutely real, and it's absolutely scary. There's no denying climate science. And you're hearing this from a physician. I base my work on science and probabilities, it's coming from a doctor. I've been a doctor for since 1989. The science should not be taken lightly, or the science, it must always be challenged, but it's reached a point in the depth where it is real science, and its predictions are and the predictions that this science is making are dire predictions for our survival in the next century. It's basically like saying there's an asteroid heading to the planet and it's 200 million miles away, but our science and our mathematics, as shown by 20 computers using different methods, have shown that this will impact the Earth in 50 years. I think people would pay attention to that, and I don't know why that would be more considered than this. You know, I just don't understand that. Maybe people can visualize the asteroid more as opposed
to this. Yeah,
it's
just like
being,
COVID. If people could see the virus, then they would.
Yes, people see the virus, but you can't really see climate change. I mean, you can see a polar bear in the Arctic, but I think it's hard to translate that into, you know, my life, you know.
Right. Well, it's even hard to imagine, like, the oceans rising, you know. And, you know, it's like, how are you going to tell? I think there's things like that the imagination will only go so far. But
I think that
most people really do know there's a problem. I just feel like they don't feel like it will touch them personally.
And that's the issue. Yes, that's an important issue.
Yeah. And it's, you know, if you're older, and you don't have children, maybe you don't care. You know, if you're going to be gone before it gets really bad, I guess maybe you don't care. I don't
know. That's not very nice.
I don't. And I don't understand that. I just don't understand that.
I can't see it, but, you know, it's even like, you know, when you go by some places where they're developing and they're tearing out all the trees, I wonder, you know, if people ever stop and think, if we keep building these great big complexes, which are sitting empty right now, and tearing down the trees and getting rid of all the plant life, where do we think we're going to get oxygen from?
Exactly.
Yeah. Nature is not infinite.
Yeah.
Nor does nature care about the human race.
We were just in a hurricane. In Hurricane Sally, and we didn't get hurt, but the area near us got, you know, battered. And then trees did come down in areas because we were also in a forested area where we're staying. And so where we were, we expect was, you know, a major, major flood zones, and we're getting every alarm bells going off. And so where we were was fine. And we kept running out and looking because there was so much rain because we got this tropical storm on top of it. But the water didn't flood where we were. And we were on a farm that has been left natural. There's some growing on it, but it's done in a nice way. And, there's something about the way the sand and the soil is and the health of the soil. And, you know, I went afterwards, I'd go run an errand and go down the road and places are flooded and trees are like down and there are some serious issues. But these are all areas that had concrete. And these are all these, you know, you pave paradise. And when a hurricane or something like comes through, that is actually a natural occurrence, but we're getting a whole bunch of them now, a little bit more than normal, then there's no place for the water to go. And if your soil isn't healthy or you've covered up the soil, Mother Nature can't help you anymore. But if Mother Nature was there, it would have been, you know. So it was really interesting just to watch that difference, you know, and see just, I mean, a matter of 2 miles difference. It's amazing what the difference was of what nature does. But we do need to take care of nature, and I really appreciate what you've done with your book, and I really encourage people to go and get it. It's delightful reading, in that you're a really good writer. You get everyone snuck, you know, right in there immediately. You connect with Abby, so, you know, so fast. I love her art project. I'm like, I want to go do that. So really, it's a great read, and I'm excited to finish it. But I love that you really do have that, you know, the banner of hope there, because we need that. We absolutely do. And hope will happen. You know, we'll get through it if we do take action. Sam, it's out everywhere, bookstores everywhere. Go, if you're independent bookstores, we got to support them too. The book, again, is The Edge of Elsewhere, and the author is Sam Stia. Sam, we got music for you. We always like to play music for people, and I think you might recognize it. Yeah, but we appreciate you joining us. It's been a true pleasure connecting with you and hearing your thoughts
and
your writing.
Lisa.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you, Nancy and Lisa. Yes.
Are you going to do more? Are you going to write more?
Oh, I'm starting. I guess I have to. Once you do it once, it kind of gets in your blood. So, you know, it's like doing running. It's like, you know, you kind of get addicted to it and it's hard to stop. So, yes, I'm working on something new.
Oh, cool.
Oh, good.
Very good.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, we really appreciate work and we appreciate your work in the health side of things, too. And being able to connect the dots, I think that's an important thing, too. But here is your song. This is from our friends at the Madisons. They're up in Greenville, Tennessee, in the Appalachian area. And this is from their latest album. And the album is called About Tomorrow, which is a good theme for your book, right? And song, this is a cover, their version of For What It's Worth. And just going back into the hippie part that we were.
I love that song. That was the group, I can't remember the group's name. The Yardbirds. Was that the Yard? No, was that the Yardbirds?
No.
No,
it's oh no.
Oh,
no.
No. Oh, it was.
I've got to get it. No, Buffalo Springfield.
Buffalo, yes, Buffalo Springfield, yes. We must capture that zeitgeist of change
yes.
and hope
from
Absolutely. That time. Yes, indeed.
So I think this is the perfect song. I was like, oh, we got to play this. Yeah.
Right.
For what it's worth, everybody, again, this is the Madisons covering it. You can get it on their latest album, About Tomorrow, and you can go to madisonsmusic.com for more about that. And we get to see them, hopefully, when we get there this month sometime. So
cool.
Here it is, everyone, for what it's worth. Everyone, please take care and wear your mask. And everyone, keep up with our shows at bigblendradio.com. We always appreciate you all listening. And thank you, Sam. Here it is.
Thank you. Thank you, Nancy. Please. Yeah.